Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to those committed to leveraging innovation to make the world a better place. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Paul Yamazaki is a legend of modern literature, a real if-you-know-you-know figure. But he's not a writer, editor, or publisher. Instead, he's the head book buyer at City Lights, a position that he's held for decades. Now in a new slim volume, Reading the Room, A Bookseller's Tale, we get to hear directly from Yamazaki about how he sees the role of a bookseller in our culture. It's a book about building an institution, about how to read a bookstore, and about how a countercultural North Beach scene became something much longer lasting. That's all coming up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. There's something inspiring about Paul Yamazaki's new book, Reading the Room, A Bookseller's Tale. At a time when it feels like our culture takes random turns built from 10-second video clips, Yamazaki's story is really about one person's 50-year effort to direct and even change what people read. His life is an argument that the world of letters is still meaningful. Colson Whitehead said of him, all booksellers are the unsung heroes of American literature, but Paul Yamazaki is a superhero. My own book editor told me this morning, you should have Paul on every morning, or at least once a week. People trust Yamazaki's curation and his wisdom about bookselling, and we hope to get a little of both for you this morning. We're delighted to welcome you to Forum, Paul.
Alexis, good morning. It's great to be here. Thank you.
So I want to go back a little bit to the beginning. You know, you've worked at City Lights for, you know, over 50 years. What did that bookstore look like when you first started there?
It looked much the same. We didn't have as much space, but, you know, it was dense and filled with books, and it was like a place of wonder for a young reader like myself. Yeah. And so it already at that point had so much history that, you know, people like Leroy Jones had walked through there, through Diane De Prima had walked through there, Allen Ginsberg, of course. And so it was just rich and deep with history, and I hope we've been able to kind of add to that over the decades.
Well, and how'd you get to start working there?
I was very involved in the strike at San Francisco State University. It was college in those days, and as we were trying to establish a college of ethnic studies, one of my mentors and close colleagues was a poet named Francis Oka, and Francis worked at City Lights, and so myself and another poet, George Leong, we'd often spend a large portion of Francis's shifts just hanging around the cash register and talking with him and looking at books.
You worked there before you worked there, basically.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
And then what happened, like, to actually get you the job?
So because of my activities at State, I was arrested and sentenced to 2 6-month concurrent sentences, which I was down at San Bruno and also on Bryant Street. And to get an early release, I needed somebody who would employ me. And Francis went to Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Shig Morrow and Bob McBride, who's the manager at that point, and explained my situation. And so they hired me sight unseen based off of Francis's recommendation.
Wow. But you hadn't grown up as, like, a bookish figure. You know, in your book, I think you say you had a 2.0 GPA. So, like, how does a high school kid who was obviously very disinterested in high school turn into someone who, you know, is one of the most respected readers, you know, in the country?
I don't think there's a real answer to that, but I'll try to attempt that. I think because of coming of age in the late 60s and coming to San Francisco specifically, within such a short period of time, there was so much happening that, you know, I'm running and was standing in the same room with David Hilliard at a fundraiser.
Right.
Yes. At a fundraiser for the Panthers at the Surf Theater, you know, which is out in the Sunset District, which is also a very historic San Francisco institution that affected a lot of us. But music, politics, culture of all sorts, writing was exploding all over the Bay Area. You know, you had writers like Al Young and Ishmael Reed who were not just doing their own writing, but with editing and doing anthologies and magazines and bringing together a lot of writers of color. So it was extremely exciting, and it would be almost impossible not to be affected by that.
Yeah. How did this actual book come together? Because, at least to my knowledge, you have not written a ton in your career. That you've been a reader, not a writer. So how did you put this together?
Well, just to be absolutely clear, Alexis, I did not write a single word of this. a great bookseller, Jeff Deutsch, who's also the publisher of this book, is, I should explain, the director of Seminary Co-op, which is a tremendous bookstore adjacent to the University of Chicago. It has a long and legendary history and is probably, in the English-speaking world, one of the most deeply respected scholarly and trade bookstores anywhere. And so Jeff has started a new imprint called Ode Books that will talk about issues within the larger literary and book ecology. And so he asked me if I would write a book, and I said no. and this is in 2020, and the pandemic is raging. And he asked a couple more times, and I gave him the same answer. I hate to write. I'm a terrible writer. And he persisted and said he came up with an alternate idea that he would fly out from Chicago and sit on my front porch for a couple days, and we would talk. And so I had done a lot of that with Jeff over the years, and I said, okay. But the remarkable thing was that out of 32 hours of tape, that Jeff created a structure for the book and edited down, much like a documentary film editor would do, with like masses amount of material and just trying to figure structure and narrative flow. And he did a magnificent job. I think my voice is recognizable in the book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of my favorite parts of this book is when you talk about what it's like to actually lay out all the books in a bookstore. And you say something like, you know, you walk into a bookstore, like the ocean looks the same, but of course it's like, it's always different. Yeah. It's always changing. So if someone were to walk into City Lights, like right now, and they look out at that ocean, like where should they focus their attention so they can really see what you're trying to do there?
That is such a question for each individual reader, and I think it's one of the magic that good independent bookstores do is that it's each step into once you cross the portal of our stores is a journey that the reader determines for themselves. What we do at City Lights is try to create a sense of disorientation that the first books that you see in the window before you step in and what the books that are featured and faced out are things that you may not recognize that haven't gotten a lot of publicity. Mm. And we identify writers early in their career. I mean, Colson is a good example, and I'm very grateful to him for saying such kind words about him. But I think one of the reasons why he did is that we recognize Intuitionist, his first book.
Really. One of my favorite books, like all time.
We totally agree on that. And it was so exciting. It's one of the privileges of being a bookseller is that you get to see writers at their early portions of the career and be able to follow their arc.
Yeah. I mean, The Intuitionist, the book you just mentioned by Colson Whitehead, really, it is just so tremendously good. And, of course, he also really developed as a writer, and you got to see him grow and change. I know another writer that you also recognized early was, for folks who may have heard, Percival Everett last week on the show, notoriously cantankerous and also brilliant. What did you see in Percival Everett's writing that said, like, this is someone to watch?
The particular of language, the uniqueness of vision and his ability to kind of look deeply into the culture through his characters and through his stories. Mm-hmm. I think really, and I think it's one of the things that I look for when I'm reading writers is exactly those qualities. And Percival has always surprised. In terms of the style he uses, in terms of the stories he tells and how he tells them is there's not a clear trajectory, and he's always challenging himself and and the reader.
One part of the legend of Paul Yamazaki that I've always loved is that your, like, quote-unquote office, as such, has usually been inside one of the North Beach spots, right? Zoetrope or Vesuvio or wherever. Do you still have that practice, or did the pandemic, like, eliminate the need for you to go in and, you know, hang around North Beach?
I don't do it as much as often, but I still consider a bar stool the most effective social media. And so the short answer is I don't get in often that much, but I'm working mostly from my front porch. But I still think it's the best way to talk about books and exchange ideas.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the scene in the Bay Area, let's call it, but, you know, bookselling around the world of letters, do you feel like it has degraded since you began, or do you feel like we look back at that time of, say, you know, the late 60s and the literature that was then and kind of overestimated, actually?
I don't think we overestimated, but I think we have grown and developed. I think right now is one of the most exciting periods over the many decades I've been doing this. And there's so many writers who have been writing for a long time, but also new writers who are entering the scene, and that's been steady and it's been developing. And one of the things that makes me very happy is that we're seeing more writers of color, a greater class diversity, and who's being published from a wide range of publishing houses. And so it's not just New York. We can look around the country and see these emerging presses. And I'm happy to say the Bay Area has some of the most interesting literary publishers in the United States.
You know, we also couldn't get through this first segment without mentioning Lawrence Ferland Getty, too, right? How do you think it was really kind of a partnership of kind of that original aura that Ferland Getty brought, plus your eye, that have kind of created modern City Lights, would you say?
I think Lawrence's vision is so profound, and he was just so kind of had his own acute taste, but he also was very astute in terms of who he selected to work with. And so we've only had two directors at City Lights, Nancy Peters, who is a really essential part of our story, and then Elaine Katzenberger, who's our current director and who I've worked with for over 30 years. And so our City Lights' long-term sustainability is based off of Lawrence's vision and his ability to kind of pick the right people to work with who share his vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're talking with Paul Yamazaki. He's City Lights Bookstore's chief book buyer, author of a new book, Reading the Room, A Bookseller's Tale. We would also really love to hear from you. You know, is there a book that you walked into City Lights, you crossed that portal, that you discovered that you don't think you would have discovered anywhere else? We'd love to hear that from you. You can, of course, email us that at forum@kqed.org. You can go on any of our social channels, head over to the Discord and get in some conversation over there, or you can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more from Paul Yamazaki.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Paul Yamazaki. He's City Lights Bookstore's chief book buyer, author of the new book, Reading the Room, A Bookseller's Tale. We want to bring in another voice into this. Stephen Sparks is co-owner of Point Reyes Books and Wayfinder Bookshop in Fairfax. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Stephen, you've known Paul for years. He's been a mentor, a friend to you. You even said that Paul made you want to become a bookseller. I mean, how did Paul make you want to pursue this kind of quixotic career?
Well, I can both praise and blame him for that, I think. I'd been in bookselling actually pretty much my entire adult life, moved out to the Bay Area, got a job at Green Apple where I was for years, and kind of had thought, you know, like, what's next? What am I going to do? And then I met Paul, and, you know, after many conversations at one of his office spots, you know, various places in North Beach, I kind of realized through Paul's, you know, both his example and just his willingness to kind of share knowledge and to have those conversations, you know, that there is a future, and this is a profession, which I think a lot of booksellers early on kind of struggle with, because you don't see the full kind of ecosystem in the way that that Paul demonstrates clearly, and, you know, the sort of horizontal aspect of our industry that I've learned through Paul to, you know, just talk to people and have those conversations. So I'm both grateful and some days, you know, pull my hair out that I've ever met Paul.
I mean, it's funny, Paul, in the book, you really do talk about being a bookseller as if you are, you know, blacksmiths, or you have like a guild in this way. Like, I think there is a sense that this is like a calling, practically, not just like a job of, you know, punching the register with books.
Well, it's definitely a calling. And I think one of the points that Stephen brings out is like how difficult it is at the early part of a career, in large part because of the economics, that the margins are so thin in all aspects of so-called book industry, that it is hard to kind of, and getting more difficult to kind of see a trajectory as a bookseller. It's particularly a challenge in almost any major urban area, mm-hmm. because as cost of living goes up. Just to give an example, just when I started, I could live within 10 minutes of City Lights, and my rent was $90. And so it's so much different now for my younger colleagues and booksellers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Stephen, I mean, you took over Point Reyes Books fairly recently. Maybe it's not actually that recent, just time has been erased in my mind. But when you took over Point Reyes Bookstore, what did you do? Like, how did you decide, okay, this is what this particular space, this particular independent bookstore should have on the shelves?
Well, having I mean, 2017, so January 1st, 2017, and that was an example of a situation where the owners wanted to find the right people, and they put this call out, very, very book industry kind of thing. You know, they could have chosen anyone who could have given them cash. And my wife and I joked that I worked at Green Apple, which was, you know, a bookstore, and she worked for 826 Valencia. So we joked that we worked for a no-profit and a non-profit, and how are we going to buy this bookstore? And so, you know, like we settled in. I mean, of course, we had our vision. I'd been the new book buyer at Green Apple for almost 10 years at that point. So I had my own ideas of what I wanted. But then you also kind of grow into the space, and you have those conversations, which end up becoming so important. And just kind of inhabiting the actual physical space itself to see what works where, and it kind of like, there is sort of a, you know, I'm more of a, there's an art and a science to it. I'm more of an art to the book selling thing, you know, where you kind of move things around and you let the books talk. And so in that space, I kind of felt like, okay, who am I talking to? Who's coming in? You know, what is it that I want? You know, what is it that's going to give me the most joy, honestly, out of this? And I think, you know, as long as we're conveying that kind of joy and enthusiasm through, you know, us and our booksellers, that counts for a lot. You know, people come in wanting expertise and wanting recommendations, and, you know, kind of getting out of those algorithmically derived pathways that we all find ourselves getting increasingly, you know, warped into. And so I think that passion and that enthusiasm really matters, and kind of let the booksellers and let the conversations guide the store in a way, as long as, you know, as well as with our idiosyncratic tastes. To promote those authors and books that we care about deeply.
Yeah, I mean, every bookstore, independent bookstore, really does have, you know, a personality that's mapped to the place who's buying books and also just the place itself, you know. So what do you feel, before we let you go, what do you feel when you go into City Lights?
I mean, it was a mecca in my first visit to San Francisco, of course, went to City Lights. And it was, I mean, I grew up in a small town in New Jersey, South Jersey, with no bookstores, kind of a cultural wasteland, and discovered Kerouac and through Kerouac, Gary Snyder. And I joke that Gary Snyder was probably, reading Gary Snyder at 16 was probably the reason I ended up in the Bay Area. And I, you know, to your question earlier that you asked, I discovered a collection of essays by Elliot Weinberger, who has since become a friend. And I discovered that at City Lights. Must have been on my first trip there in 2004, maybe. And, you know, I remember where I found that book in the basement, and reading it kind of opened my eyes to this whole other world. I hadn't been exposed to that at that point. You know, and so I can, like, ultimately thank Yamazaki for that. Just that sense of, you know, this, for a non-religious person, I feel like, you know, there's something sacred about that City Lights building just being among those titles and people.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much, Stephen Sparks, co-owner of Point Reyes Books and Wayfinder Bookshop in Fairfax. Thanks so much for joining us. We're talking with Paul Yamazaki, City Lights Bookstore's chief book buyer. You know, Stephen kind of mentioned this a little bit, Paul, about sort of what book buying actually looks like. You know, you're not just buying, say, the new titles that have come out. There's also all the backlists of the houses and all that kind of stuff. Like, what's your process for that? Like, the actual sort of, like, placing the orders?
Well, you sit, everything is that I do is based around conversation, and one of the essential conversations is with the publisher sales reps. The big New York houses have what we call house reps, who are on the payroll of whatever particular publishing house, and there's also independent commission reps who have their own businesses and then represent a huge variety of different presses. But one of the questions that I think is crucial to how I do it is that if I see a book in my hand and I really, really like the book, I ask the publisher's sales rep, who was the acquiring editor? And over the years, that has become such a valuable tool in terms of being able to look slightly over the horizon of literary production and be able to appear a lot smarter than I actually am.
Because those editors are, say, you know, acquiring things which may not show up in the market for 4 or 5 years. So if you're in touch with them, you're sort of get a preview, even if you don't have the book in your hand.
Yes, and then you get a sense of what their sensibilities are and how that, in our case, meshes with City Lights. And so we can anticipate what a writer may do or the trajectory that they're on. And that's both, in a practical sense, very good for City Lights. And then as a personal reader, it's really kind of opens up gateways and vistas that may not have happened if I hadn't asked that question and become acquainted with that particular editor.
Yeah. We're talking with Paul Yamazaki, City Lights chief book buyer. We're also hearing from you as well. Is there a book you discovered at City Lights that you think you wouldn't have discovered anywhere else? Let's bring on our first caller for that, Timitha in San Francisco. Welcome, Timitha.
Hi. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
Okay. We had a previous conversation at Wildside West.
Yeah. Oh, I remembered. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm calling now because I was a friend for a very long time with Diane De Prima, whom I met at Huey Newton's funeral, and Michael McClure, and all the Beats, who I started adoring when I was in high school. Oh, wow. So,
what do you
City
think?
Lights, I can't imagine a world without City Lights.
Yeah. Is there like one particular book, or was it more just like that City Lights created a space, like as Paul said earlier, like a portal within the city that lets you access this whole kind of literary world?
Exactly that. Yeah. I mean, all of Diane De Prima's work for sure. And Michael McClure, which are the names that are coming up, and other beats. That City Lights presented to them. You know, in fact,
I think we lost Timitha. Sorry about that, Timitha. Paul, what I wanted to ask you about the relationship between, you know, the Beats, as Timitha said, and City Lights, right? Because it is kind of a complex thing, especially through time.
Yeah, Lawrence really deeply respected the writers that, you know, now we call the Beats, but he personally did not want to be identified because he thought the definition was too narrow. And I think as we look as Lawrence's own writing and we look as his work as a publisher and an editor, is that we can see that he was interested in how the many rivers and streams of critical literary resistance and hope were part of his thinking, and he really deeply respected the Beats, but he thought that was just one of the streams and rivers, and he was really looking at the whole kind of ecology and history.
When you are buying books and you're looking at all these different book titles, like, how many titles do you consider per year to select, you know, that set of them, which will make its way, you know, onto the shelves and eventually, you know, into the minds of readers?
There's no real precise figure, but I'm estimating that I look at between 30 and 50,000 pieces of catalog copy to select about 6,000 titles on an annual basis.
Wow. Wow. How many of those do you think you end up reading?
Oh, it's such a small fraction. I think what I pick up and read 25 pages of hundreds of books a year, but completing a book is probably, what, 50 would be a generous guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. Josh writes, what other bookstore would put a narrow bookshelf of French surrealist texts by Apollinaire, Breton, Nerval, Jarre right near the cash register? Impulse buys that will blow your mind. My own poetry and life was shaped by these texts thanks to City Lights. And don't get me started on a subterranean room for music and philosophy and a loft room for poetry. Their very structure of the building is like a house of letters. That's beautiful reflection. I mean, it also gestures at doing unusual things that don't seem to have a monetary or financial basis, right? I mean, if you sold Kerouac memorabilia right by the cash register, you might sell more of that than you sell of, you know, French surrealist texts.
I think that's exactly correct. But I think that there again, we have to credit Lawrence and a little bit of serendipity. Is it? The original store was that little kind of 300 square feet where the right around the register is right now. But what Lawrence and Shig and Peter Martin original intention was to give a place where ideas can be exchanged, books can be read but not necessarily purchased. I mean, ideally that would be the case, but that wasn't the major intent. The intent was to for the reader to be able to ruminate and contemplate the text, and that City Lights would provide that space. The original store space was very small, and so people were literally shoulder to shoulder. But as that wonderful commentary was, that as we got the basement a few years later, that really became a place of deep reading, and people would spend literally hours there. And I was one of those young people who happened to do that too, also. Mm.
You know, another listener wondered about how specifically your formative experience at San Francisco State and how that influenced your desire to work with books. Were those two kind of separate things? SF State was really more about like a time of activism and, you know, political consciousness, and then books came later?
No, I think they were really kind of, because of my association with Francis Oka, that I began to know how books and his work at City Lights, how books were important to his development. But State is really foundational for me as a reader and as a bookseller. The issues that we raised that were raised at San Francisco State, and the desire and the creation of a College of Ethnic Studies is important to how I look and select books for City Lights.
Hmm. How so?
Well, using my background and heritage as a Japanese American and the close allegiance that I have that was in part formed by all people of color, and looking at that historically allowed me to kind of like take a much broader and somewhat different look at literary production. Mm.
Yeah, I've been kind of fascinated looking back at SF State literature and seeing how many different kind of individual, like national groups there were, you know, all the, like the Filipino group, and you had the Mexican group, and you had all these different things and at Berkeley as well. And then during the time you were there, during this Third World Strike, they all do find a way to a very real and serious kind of solidarity. Yeah.
No, that's absolutely correct. And I think that solidarity is something that I've carried with me for all these decades later. And it still is a foundational piece of how I look at what the publishers are offering, and I think it helps make City Lights distinctive. One of the things that makes me extremely proud is when a writer of color comes in and tells me that, you know, that seeing themselves reflected in the books that are on the shelves of City Lights made it possible for them to envision a life as a writer. And so that's, nothing makes me prouder when I hear a comment like that from a writer.
Roberto writes in to say, you know, it's wonderful to hear these important histories. My father, poet Roberto Vargas, must have crossed paths with you given his organizing at San Francisco State involvement in the poetry scene. Do you have any stories of the Glide publication of Time to Grease, 1973, or editorial Pochoche, which published many poets of that time?
It's one of the remarkable things is that, you know, that Janice Mirakatani, who was at Glide for many years and was the primary mover for Time to Grease. All the things that came out of State, you know, then kind of continued to work in all the neighborhoods. And so Time to Grease, like, who brought writers from so many different backgrounds and so many different neighborhoods, was really an important part of how I think it was foundational to what the Before Columbus and the American Book Awards. And it's I'm thank you for and Roberto was Vargas was hugely important in all these things, organizing in the Mission, organizing at State, putting together these various literary collections and himself as a writer contributing to them.
We're talking with Paul Yamazaki, City Lights chief buyer, author of the new book, Reading the Room, A Bookseller's Tale. Earlier, you heard from Stephen Sparks, co-owner of Point Reyes Books. We'd love to hear from you. What does City Lights mean to you? What's it meant to you in your life? You can email us forum@kqed.org. Find us on all the social channels. You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Stay tuned for more.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Paul Yamazaki, City Light chief book buyer. He's been doing it for 50 years, author of a new book as well called Reading the Room, A Bookseller's Tale. Let's bring in a couple of other booksellers here. Melinda Powers is head book buyer of Bookshop Santa Cruz and the president of CALIBA, the California Independent Booksellers Alliance. Welcome, Melinda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Hannah Oliver Depp, owner of Loyalty Bookstores in D.C. and Maryland. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Hannah, let's start with you. I mean, Loyalty Bookstores are primarily focused on representing Black and BIPOC authors and works. How do you fill out your shelves? How do you think about it?
Oh, I mean, you think about it first and foremost as like what books excite myself and the co-owner, Christine Ballo, and all of our booksellers who are from so many different backgrounds. And if we're genuinely excited about a book, then there's a good bet the community will be excited. You also look around and think about what the needs of the community are. Are there any issues going on that people are going to want to read about? Mm. Is there some joy in your community that has not been traditionally celebrated or seen on a bookshelf? And you look at the quality of the writing. That's the privilege of a bookstore. We get to shelve what we actually like to read.
Yeah. How did you meet Paul?
I met Paul at a book conference. And he was, you know, you're in sometimes conference rooms with a lot of people, and you're in conference rooms sometimes with only a few handful of people. But either way, often in traditional book selling, there's only a couple people of color in the room. And Paul came up to me with a very, very like hearty presence. And of course, I knew who he was, but I'd never met him before. And he came up to me like an old friend and asked me what I was excited about reading and just started talking. And I knew it was a gesture that he'd seen me, that we were in a safe space together. But also I was shocked at just how much he truly wanted to be in conversation with a bookseller he'd never met before, who he did not know the background of. And, you know, we turned out we had a lot in common, and it was an incredible conversation, but it trained me how to approach conversing with my fellow booksellers and brought me into a community of readers and entrepreneurs that I treasure. He led by example.
Yeah. Paul, what do you want to talk about with booksellers? Are you guys, you know, going through titles, talking about sales, or is it the world of ideas, or what is it?
All those things. It's why that I'd like to sit down and be able to kind of mull over these things most preferably with a drink, and because it is for booksellers, it's the ideas, but we have to talk about the commerce because we have institutions and people who are dependent on how we do these things. So it's not just kind of the world of ideas, but it is the hard concrete of, like, you know, how do we keep our doors open? How do we keep our staff safe and provided for it to the best way, because the staffs are really essential to all our stores. I mean, we may be really good at what we do, but we don't exist without our staffs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Melinda Powers? I know you're obviously head of this association. How have you seen bookselling kind of evolve over this time that we're talking here, Paul's tenure?
Yeah. I mean, I think that to what they were saying, there's always the fun idea creating part of bookselling that we think of and we enjoy talking about. But there was a moment where that was enough to just sell books. You could just open mom and pop stores could open, you know, open and just create this magical world, and it was working. And then as different changes kept and challenges kept coming, you know, through with like big chains and different channels and things like that, I feel like one of the things that Paul's generation and generations between that and now has really codified the business, brought the business of bookselling into the mix as well, and really kind of, like to what Paul said, grounded the two together so that this is both a profession and a business, but also one that generates ideas and joy and creativity and curiosity. So I feel like that's that the trajectory is this continued expansion of like girding ourselves with the economic sustainability and in ways that have become more creative and imaginative and diverse, but then also having that sustainability level allow us to continue to do the quote unquote more fun parts of it in some ways.
You know, I mean, given all the competition, you know, particularly from the tech platforms and just this sort of endlessness of Amazon, what kind of conversations are you having about the future of like sort of independent bookstores, you know, in the Bay Area?
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about, I mean, both of those pieces. And I think that one of the exciting parts, especially one of the byproducts of the pandemic and the shutdown, is that independent bookstores were forced to think differently about how they continue to sell books and to get books into the hands of their customers. And I think that really allowed us to imagine more pop-up stores, more diverse ways of getting into communities that didn't have bookstores before. And I think that that's another step in opening up this idea of what does independent bookselling look like? Is it the mom and pop bricks and mortar store on your corner, or is it one that roves differently? But all of those, the through line is still this idea of being really connected to the community that they're in, and both providing and enticing, the community with different books and ideas. So.
We're talking about sort of the business and art of bookselling. We're joined by Paul Yamazaki, head book buyer at City Lights, Melinda Powers, head book buyer at Bookshop Santa Cruz and president of the California Independent Booksellers Alliance, as well as Hannah Oliver Depp, owner of Loyalty Bookstores in D.C. and Maryland. I want to bring in another caller here. Let's bring in Mona in Madera.
Hi.
Oh yeah, go ahead. You're on. Oh, no, we lost her. Tough. She had a great question, too, which was about Robin Sloan's Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore, a love letter to independent bookstores everywhere, I think, Paul. Paul, here's another question here. Pure City Lights. You have a stack of books, and you want to recommend some of them. Like, what are the things that in that particular stack you would say, like, yes, this is like perfect City Lights, or this is like the future of books? Like, what are those books?
Well, actually, as you asked that question, I do have a stack of books here in the studio that of recent books that I really love and would love to put in the hands of readers. And so what do you look for? You look for that kind of, you know, depth and critical awareness, and you don't know how each reader is going to respond to that. But if I respond in a particular way, I know there's going to be other readers. It's the other basis of what we do at City Lights is we trust the reader. We don't think about audience in particular. We don't see if we're going to try to address this need or that need. We have the privilege of being able to just take a look at these books, and if we really love them and think that they're important, that we can put them out there and we trust the reader to find them. And I think after 71 years that trust is, our trust in the readers is paid off for us.
So tell us about one of them in the stack.
So the top one here is Dark Soil by one of my favorite writers, Karen Tay Yamashita. And this is actually a mixture of fiction essays by a community of writers, but it's centered on Karen's work and how you look at place and how do you look at the history of place and what gets ignored, what gets featured. And so she uses, in the way that Karen is so imaginative, like we were talking about Percival Everett before, she is able to walk around the circumference of something she's interested in and find so many different ways of approaching that. And it's I haven't finished this book yet. That's the reason why it's on the top of my pile. but I was literally enraptured when I started reading it, and
Yeah, I love that. Hannah, how about a book you would recommend that you feel like gets at what you're trying to do with loyalty bookstores?
Absolutely. So we have a book that I love, Shannon Sanders' Company, and it's a short story collection from Grey Wolf Press, one of our great independent presses. And it's a cast of characters, intergenerational family narrative, but it also takes place in a apartment building, a small little multi-floor situation, and each story takes place in a different room and a different moment of the same party. And honestly, it's an incredible character study, but all of the people are so recognizable. I feel like I could walk into definitely any stoner's building in DC that's been split up into a couple different places and find some recognizable folks there who reminded me of my own community.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And Melinda Powers, how about you? Bookshop Santa Cruz, what would you say is a book you would recommend that it's like, this is gets to the heart of our store?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm such a big fan right now of a book called You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World.
The Ada Limón edited.
It is. Yeah. It's edited and curated by Ada Limón. And it collects 50 poets and their unpublished works that speak to different ways, that we interact and are in the natural world. And I think that's really part of what Santa Cruz is and does. I mean, it's just a beautiful place to be, but also it's just, this is the type of book to what Hannah was saying that I just love showing, like bringing into the store to like, everybody needs to see this book. It's so exciting. And it's an opportunity to be like, no, this is the joy that I want you to find. So.
I love it, too, because it also extends kind of what a book can be, too, because it's also in a bunch of the national parks. The poetry has sort of gone in there. Like, it has this sense of a book that goes beyond its borders, you know, beyond its covers. Let's bring in another car. Let's bring in Peter in San Francisco. Welcome, Peter.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having this terrific conversation. I love bookstores. I love the different personalities. I love bookstores that have new or used or both kinds of books. I'm very concerned, though, about the growing, I would say, competition, if you like, of electronic and web-based booksellers and electronic books, for that matter. I mean, it's fine with me if somebody wants ebooks, but I'm concerned also about, you know, the very great reduction in the number of bookstores in San Francisco and I think everywhere else because in large measure, I think the internet. So I'm wondering what your guests might have to say about that and the future for bookstores.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter, and we have, you know, new ones are opening, I hear, but also it is a difficult business, Paul. Like what has been your response? Obviously, you know, the internet and the possibility of buying books online has been, you know, part of San Francisco life for a while, and City Lights has thrived anyway. What do you kind of attribute that to?
Well, I think there has been a sharp decline if we were looking like over the last 40-year period, but if we look at the last 5-year period, we're starting to see an emergence of a younger generation of booksellers who are really clearly cognizant of the challenges and problems that being a brick and mortar bookstore have, but also clearly recognize the pleasures and the potentiality of independent bookstores. And I think it's all of us who are booksellers who've spoken today, what we've seen is like, you know, bookstores and loyalty and Point Reyes are perfect examples of booksellers with like this vision and this capacity for hard work and wanting to share a literary vision through books with their communities. And it's so for me, it's very heartening. Yes, the challenges are there. And if people written this brick and mortar independence off many times, but it's but I'm very excited, just as I'm excited about the emerging writers coming up, I am also equally excited about the emerging booksellers.
Yeah. And I think you say something like, you know, every year there's something that's supposed to like wipe out independent bookstores, and here you are. Hannah, how about you? How have you responded? I mean, I one thing I imagine is that, you know, the algorithmic recommendation systems that exist out there do kind of lock people into particular modes of thought and ways of being, it seems to me. Are booksellers, or do you see your role as kind of helping to like crack out of that? Or do you see it as like being even better at like finding exactly the thing that that person already knows they want to read?
Yeah, I think I tend not to think of it as an either or situation. Mm-hmm. Right when I became, you know, a bookseller 12, 13 years ago, it was, you know, the dawn of ebooks, and they were supposed to kill us, and they didn't. And then audiobooks were supposed to kill us again, or that, I don't know. And each time indie bookstore finds a way to work with them. And I think with things like Bookstagram and BookTok and individual recommenders who may or may not be booksellers or reviewers or just deep online enthusiasts are feeding into an algorithm, and sometimes the same book gets shown over and over. And what often happens is a customer comes in prompted by that to the bookstore, and then they have a conversation with the bookseller and learn there's so much more. And so I take it as a win. If something's getting people interested in books, I'm going to work with it, not against it.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul Yamazaki, how long do you think you're going to do this? Do you want to be someone who, like, you know, that's it till the day you go, pass on? Or do you think eventually you're going to hang up the cleats and do something else?
Right now, because I get so much pleasure out of this and I'm still capable, as long as I'm still capable and have this community of wonderful editors, booksellers, and writers around me, I think I'll just keep doing this.
I mean, it sounds like this is more a life than a job, you know?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Couple other listener comments. One listener on Discord writes, I love the Surrealist bookshelf at City Lights. I studied the Surrealists in college and have kept my interest up with them. That shelf has been a lifeline. Also, the book put out by City Lights, The Gnostics, is one of my favorite books ever. Sean writes in to say, I think Yamazaki balances thinking globally and locally exactly right and has a good sense of publishing and bookselling as an ecosystem. He knows City Lights has a special place in the ecosystem and is genuinely grateful for it, but he's also not resting on his laurels selling Jack Kerouac postcards. Every day he's doing the work, pulling up his spreadsheets, wrapping his wrists in tape to keep going, and then drinking and talking the night away. Because the real thing he believes in is conversation. That's a beautiful little tribute from an editor at MCD to Paul Yamazaki, City Lights Bookstore's chief buyer, author of the new book, Reading the Room, A Bookseller's Tale. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Alexis, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah. We've also been joined by Melinda Powers, head book buyer of Bookshop Santa Cruz and the president of the California Independent Booksellers Alliance. Thank you so much for joining us, Melinda.
Thank you for having me.
Also been joined by Hannah Oliver Depp, owner of Loyalty Bookstores in D.C. and Maryland. Thank you so much, Hannah.
So happy to chat with y'all.
Yeah. Earlier, we heard from Stephen Sparks, who's co-owner of Point Reyes Books and Wayfinder Bookshop in Fairfax. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Did you ever wonder what it's like to live alone? Hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years. Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles. The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.